Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Alice Denby, Deputy Editor of CapEx. We often think of ancient Rome as a world of military conquest, marble statues and capricious gods. A civilization whose splendour and eventual decline inspired painters and poets for more than 2,000 years. And a system of government which provided the model for Western democracy. But as businessman and historian George Meyer argues in his book Pugnare, the reasons for both the success and the ultimate failure of ancient Rome weren't just political or cultural, but economic. I sat down for a fascinating conversation with George, whose classical research combined with his professional experience as an actuary gives him a rare insight into the comparative workings of the ancient and modern worlds. We discuss the Romans' innovations in free trade, currency and banking, and why the lessons from the empire's downfall are still relevant today. George, welcome to the CapEx podcast. Delighted to have you here to talk about your book Pugnare, Economic Success and Failure. And I thought we might start slightly controversially by talking about the end, because I think this can tell us something about why the Romans are still relevant to us today. So the front cover of your book shows these naked barbarians tearing down an imperial statue, and that's the symbol of civilization, and this is the fall of Rome. And your book is how it was the economics that made Rome the civilization that it was, the greatest city of the ancient world, an empire stretching from Syria to North Africa all the way to Britain, and how mismanagement of the economy led to this eventual collapse. And that's a warning for our times, isn't it?
It is. I mean, when we look at the Roman Empire, as you say, we see it covering a vast expanse. We see a massive amount of achievement there, massive amount of beauty, and then we see it all gone. And it's always, I think, an important thing, you know, to make sure we learn from our predecessors. And for example, when you start out in a company for the first time, one of the things you and your fellow new recruits are doing is looking at the boss and what he's doing. Is he, you know, how he manages a meeting superbly, and looking at another boss and how he's doing things in a way that you never want to copy. So learning from our predecessors is, you know, part of the key to success, I think. And so, forgetting what they do is part of the key to failure.
And that's the point, isn't it? I mean, we think of these ancient civilizations as very different to our own.
Yeah.
But actually, they're the same. These people were no better or worse than us. And it was their economic sophistication that made Rome. And your story really starts with Augustus, who comes to power as the first true Roman emperor in 27 AD. And this is kind of when we see the Romans move from a great military power to a monetary power. And tell us a bit about that.
I think what you said there is at the beginning is absolutely, you know, spot on. People don't change. You know, human nature hasn't changed in the last 100,000 of years. I mean, people live and love and die in the same way. People have successful and beautiful relationships in the same way and mess up relationships in the same way. And the fundamentals of life, the things that make us happy, you know, achievement, meaning, belonging, pleasure, haven't changed. And, you know, we all make the best of the hands that we're dealt with. they did not inherit the technology that we have inherited. They did not inherit the achievements of the great minds of the 19th century, like Faraday and Maxwell, who basically brought together electricity and magnetism to make motorism, all that. Life really doesn't change as much as people think it does. You are absolutely right also to say that the huge achievement of that society was its movement from a conquest model to a trading model. And often we hear more about the first and nothing about the second. And it was the second bit, the trade, that led Gibbons to say that the second century AD was the finest time ever to be alive. And even in comparison to our own times, that is probably still true. And I've seen things in business that I'm reminded of when I look at this transition from a conquest model to a trading model that are similar and that for me have been hugely inspiring. I've done quite a bit of work in South Africa, evaluating the potential for riots and things like that. And to see the way that society transformed itself from an apartheid exclusionary model to something which was very inclusive and liberal beyond most countries in the world. I mean, the respect for human rights there is just amazing. I mean, and to see how much of that related to one man, and without him, maybe it wouldn't have happened. But it wasn't just the one man, it was the people around him and in the country. I, with colleagues, did a lot of work for Lloyd's of London, when Lloyd's of London was at the verge of collapse. This was when I was starting out my career in London. And this was an icon of the British establishment, established in the 17th century, its unique traditions of unlimited liability, the oldest newspaper in the world, an iconic building. And because of mistakes they had made, it was at risk of implosion. And that would have devastated the London insurance market, which is premier in the world. And I'm just a bag carrier, doing what the boss tells and building models to evaluate future claims from the US on asbestos and pollution. And what I'm noticing as I'm going around sitting in these meetings is the will in the generality of the people that this will survive. And they dumped everything so that they would survive. So their unlimited liability, an inherent part of their tradition and identity, goes. Sell the newspaper, sell the building, lease it back, let in people who were previously not let in before, corporates rather than wealthy individuals, let in people from outside the country in a way they weren't let in before. And it's just that will of an organisation to survive. That just so deeply impressed me. And you see that when you look through what has survived in the literature and all the rest of the Roman Empire, you see exactly that transition. You see exactly that will to survive and to keep the good that we've known for generations continuing on. So they had a conquest model. And in a conquest model, you get rich by going out and conquering. So there's a career structure for you. And you can become, in our terms, a billionaire. And there's massive cruelty in it. The people in the country you invade and whatever, you can enslave them. Once you've settled it and they're now following your rules, you can no longer enslave them. That's a one-off opportunity. A one-off opportunity to create untold misery, cause a mother to see her son and daughter for the last time. It's unspeakable cruelty. But it brings untold wealth. I mean, Caesar enslaved a million people in Gaul. And if you value the labor of a slave at 20,000, that's 20 billion. But those opportunities were running out because they could only go so far. And the genius was then to say, we will stop people being greedy like that. We will spread the wealth more. We will make money not by conquest. We will make money by competing amongst each other in trade. And that was transformative.
And these two things are fundamentally linked, though, aren't they? Because we talk about it was the standardisation of the currency.
Yes, yes. You're absolutely right. If you want to do trade across the Mediterranean, you need to have a currency that's trusted across a wide area. You can't have one sort of currency in one village and another currency in that town over there. You need to have a common currency. And that they constructed. And the other thing which is worth saying is that if you want to have this trading empire, you need to have people who can specialise in manufacturing, fine glass, fine pottery, and all the rest. You need them to be living in big cities. And for people to live in big cities, there needs to be a money system. There's nothing that you or I have to barter with each other, but we can exchange money. And they built cities, some of which were of a size not equaled until the late 18th century. And that all rested on the currency. And as you say, part of what helped them do the work of genius of standardising it was they paid their soldiers. And their soldiers, when they went into the marketplace, expected to have the silver coins exchanged with the gold coins at the rate that Augustus said.
And how did this economic system interact with the political system in Rome? They had a very sophisticated democracy with a Senate, copied by later democracies. How did these two things relate? They were able to raise taxes for public works.
I think that's key, as you say. They are so closely related. I mean, it's a marriage. You can't talk about an economy without talking about the politics. When you compare the Soviet Union to the United States in whatever it was 30 or 40 years ago, are you comparing two economies or two political systems? And so I think what you say is just spot on. For a long time, and this was one of the things they preserved in through the transition. For a long time, they had a superb relationship between the private sector and the public sector. So the way they built buildings very quickly was the Senate, which had the money, put projects out to tender. And private individuals then built that temple, built that aqueduct or whatever, under contract, as now, selected through competition, as now, monitored by state officials, as now. And they did it hugely successfully. And the success there comes not from technology, but from how people organise themselves. And while they were successful, while they were growing and spreading their prosperity, they had this down to a T.
One of the things that I really liked about your book was all the parallels you draw between the Roman world and the modern day, and this economic system they had allowed them to have these flourishing cities, which actually, would be reasonably familiar to a modern day person. You could trade from all over the world, you could buy products from anywhere. You had artists and manufacturers specialising in the most, the tiniest things. Just paint us a bit of a picture of what Rome's economic and trading system made its cities feel like.
What did it make it feel like? That's a very good question. I think it must have been one of the most wonderful times to have been alive after the transition. The city of Rome, had been let fall into disrepair. They're emerging from a time of conflict, internal conflict. They're emerging from a time of fear, when the dominant thing that the sensible person had, the dominant objective is to survive. I want to protect my life and the lives of those whom I love, and I want to protect my property. It's a movement from that turmoil to vigour and creativity and transformation. So as you walked the city, you saw building happening everywhere. You saw the old being restored. You saw the new being introduced. And part of the genius of Augustus and part of the genius of those who are influencing events, the real genius, was to say, success isn't just money. If you make money your success, you failed. It became a time of artistic creativity. They wrote poetry and encouraged it and valued it. They wrote histories, which have survived to now, which, you know, many, many, many centuries after their economic system collapsed, was informing Shakespeare, giving him models. The son of a freed slave, Horace, wrote poetry that you can find the influence of in Shakespeare's sonnets. What you believe about yourself, you know, determines what you do, and what a nation or what a country believes about itself determines what it does. And the beliefs that they were expressing was, we have come from something, we are going somewhere, people will remember what we did, we will be inclusive, we will not reject the stranger. They are part of what fuels our growth. This man, he's only the son of a former slave. He is a superb poet. He is as valuable as any of the others. It was that, I think. An exciting time to live in those cities, of renewal, of better stuff.
And you also had, I mean, we think of things like trade specialisation as a kind of feature of globalisation,
yes.
But you had these incredibly specialised artisans. There's a guy in your book who only makes the eyes for statues.
Yes.
And you couldn't have someone do only that unless you had in tremendous demand for statues.
Yes.
So I really liked that detail. Another economic parallel in your book is the financial crisis of 33 AD, which is actually remarkably similar to what happened in 2008, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. The system depended on a banking system. And down in the Strand, there is a bank. It's called Hoare & Company. It's a private partnership, unlimited liability of the partners, who are a very old, established English family. It's been around since the 17th century. I think the customers tend to be rather grand. I don't have an account there. And that form of bank was what they had. So if Cicero is selling an estate, which in our terms is worth £10 million, he's not doing it by, you know, having carts loads of gold coins moved down. It's a transfer through the bank, through the banking system. And what happened in AD 33 was that banking system was in crisis. There was there was turmoil in the property market, just as there is in China at the moment. The crisis was caused by extreme austerity being practiced by the then head of state, the Emperor Tiberius. And like the crisis of 2008-2009, it was only solved when the central authorities injected a massive amount, something short of a billion in our terms, into the banking system in interest-free loans. So very, very similar, very, very similar to what happened back then. We depend on a functioning banking system. You can destroy that by mismanagement. And if you do, you absolutely have to rescue it. Otherwise, your infrastructure is gone.
And there was a bank bailout, wasn't there?
Yes, exactly. And they did that through interest-free loans. So the government had been resisting, and they just bailed out. They bailed out the banks.
And then we had another sort of 100-odd years of a flourishing trading empire.
Exactly.
Until things start to go wrong, and I think from the way I read your book anyway, that it started to go wrong from a combination of political problems, yep. some dodgy individuals, yep. and some economic complacency. But let's start with the sort of, well, where do you think it started to go wrong?
I think that word you used there, Alice, complacency, I think that's just mega. I mean, I think that summarizes it. Now, what I do is I lay out as a story the various things that are happening. You know, it's a narrative. It's a story. It's not a lecture. And there are lots of things that you know may have contributed to the collapse. But I think the fundamental is complacency, as you say. There had been a system that had been flourishing now for 200 years. It was something that had been around, not just in my time or my parents' time or my grandparents' time, but since time immemorial. And then what happens is people just say, well, that's the way it is. We don't need to worry. That's the way it is. You know, we have a currency in this country which has been established over hard work and superb intelligence over 200 years. And people kind of think, well, that's the way it is. Well, that's the way it is if you're not complacent and you make complacent and make sure you look out for the things that need looking out for. But you can destroy it if you're complacent. Complacency, I think, Alice, I agree with you.
But I think there are particular individuals who contribute to this downfall as well. So, I mean, Commodus is a character people might know from the film Gladiator. But he disastrously undermines the political system. Can you tell us a bit about him?
Well, I think it would have been a great fun to be around, and I think it would have been great fun to watch him perform. But he had no experience. He was just totally the wrong person. Marcus Aurelius, gets very, very, very good press, and I don't think he deserves quite as much as he gets, because he made a change. Until him, for the previous 100 years, the successor to the emperor had been selected. So people knew who he was going to be, and he wasn't the biological offspring of the previous one. He was an adopted son, but he was someone that people decided, we will have him when the current one dies, because we think he will look after the system. If Marcus Aurelius had allowed that to continue and they had not had Commodus, things would have been better. When you get on a plane, to fly from here to Ibiza or wherever, you just really want to make sure that you don't have to check it, because people do, that the man who's going to fly the plane knows how to do it. And with all due respect to yourself, when I next get on a plane, I hope you're not flying the plane, and I also hope that they're not asking me to fly the plane. He was just totally the wrong man for the job. He did not understand, and it's just amazing. People argue about this politician, that politician, all the rest, and some people like some people, and some people like other people. And any time I look at this, I just think, does that person actually understand how this thing works? And if they don't, then that's a problem. They need to understand.
And he would do things like, instead of wearing his toga at the Senate, he would dress as Hercules, and he sort of made fun of the whole institution.
No institution should be allowed to be complacent. No institution of any importance should be unaccountable. But to mock the institutions that underpin your life, livelihood and safety is very bad in a leader. It's okay if we have comedians doing it, and probably very helpful, but not if the leader's doing it. And as you say, Alice, I mean, that would have been fun to watch, but not fun to look back on 30 years later.
And as well as some of these political mistakes, there were economic policy changes that you argue precipitated the downfall, particularly, I think, a rise in sort of protectionist policies. You talk about a new law insisting that a son had to follow their father's profession. There became limits on free movement. There was this contraction. And this began to make the empire poorer. If you can tell us a bit more about that.
That's right. So the son had to follow his father's profession, but maybe the son was, you know, no good as a butcher, or maybe actually, the son's real talent was in poetry, or maybe the son's real talent was in trade, you know, in wheeler dealing and wanting to just get it from A to B and things like that. So once you do that, once you restrict people, restrict their freedom to, you know, pursue what is good for them, you're also forcing your good assets to do things that they're not good at, and that devalues your talent, that devalues your opportunities to grow, to flourish. You know, that'd be like forcing me to be a pilot. You know, you know, that's not going to be good for travel, tourism. So, and that restriction that they introduced towards the end of the 3rd century, I mean, continued in Europe right into the Middle Ages and beyond. And you only see emerging economic growth in countries such as England and freed up and people can do what they're best suited to do.
I think that's an incredible lesson from the history of the Roman Empire, that what you need for a civilization to succeed is strong political institutions and open trading and economic policies. And when they go wrong, so does your civilization.
Yes. And you need also to have a good sense of who you are and what you're about. You really do need to have values that are admirable.
And I think this is one of the reasons why the Roman Empire has held such a sway over the imagination of, you know, from Petrarch to Piranesi to Percy Shelley. It's because it's such a kind of parable about human fragility.
I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right. It's, as you so beautifully put it, it's a parable about human fragility, which is part of our story.
I think that sounds like a great place to end. Thank you so much, George. This has been fascinating.
No, it's been a great pleasure.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Marc Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Marc.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about it.
Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.